This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the return of Portland Folk Music Society concerts with artists who tour nationally. The five-concert series starts this month, Saturday, February 19th, with Robin and Linda Williams.
Gonna drink sweet honey whiskey.
Give me a good heavy load and a clear stretch of road, and I'll let that old bulldog run.
The Portland Folk Music Series has one show every month through June. The concerts will be at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's end-of-year membership drive. We challenged KBOO supporters to help us meet three donation matches and raise $45,000, and you stepped up. Your generous support, combined with hundreds of other community radio donors, helped to raise $85,000 for KBOO. We knew you could do it, and together we did.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
94.1.
What you see here is history. It's history. Never been done before. Never been done in this country. In this country.
APFA.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Hold up.
The youngest patient that I lost was 20 years old, which was devastating for me because that's not my patient population, and I have children of that age.
A lot of people are dealing with things that they may not want to talk about. To your friends, to your family, to your coworkers, they just don't want to discuss it.
There have been moments where suicide did, in fact, came into my mind, and I have had to try to I bypass that by focusing on my daughter.
Today on the show, we'll hear from people who have been struggling to keep patients alive in the emergency room, striving to find work, and trying to balance parenthood during the pandemic. We begin with Amy Arland, a registered nurse at the COVID-19 unit at the Kaiser Permanente Fresno Medical Center. Amy, considered a seasoned medical professional, had never experienced anything quite like COVID.
When you work 20 years in an ICU, you build up a level of knowledge and experience. You're considered an expert because you've taken care of the same kinds of patients for so long. You know your stuff. And with COVID, it just threw a monkey wrench in all of that. We didn't know anything. And it was very frustrating and very scary because you don't know what's coming through the door every day, and not every COVID patient is the same. Treatments were constantly changing, and in the nursing field, especially in ICU, emergency rooms, and very high-stress areas where patients are always in crisis, we learn to adapt to change very rapidly. But with COVID, the changes were minute by minute, second by second. Guidelines were all over the place. We didn't know who to trust because everything changed on a dime.
Keeping up with all the rapidly changing information about COVID was hard enough for Amy and her colleagues. But by the time the third wave of infections hit Fresno, California, Amy's COVID unit was completely overwhelmed.
By that point, we were at 100% ICU mortality for our COVID patients. We were losing them all. And that was the biggest kick in the gut for us, because we were throwing everything but the kitchen sink at these people. It's why isn't this stuff working? This was death on a massive scale. I mean, we went from an average of maybe 2 to 3 deaths a month in our ICU to having 23 deaths a month. I stopped counting after about the 175th death.
Due to the rising number of COVID deaths and the ICU consistently being short-staffed, the responsibility of body disposal regularly fell on Amy.
My patients, when they would die, would be in the middle of the night, and we did not have ancillary staff. We had no staff. We were short-staffed most of the time to bare bones, barely scraping by. So I would have to be the one to take that patient down to the morgue, and when the morgue was full, we had to take them outside to a refrigerated truck, and we would be stacking them like cordwood.
As of August 2021, an average of more than 700 people per day continue to die of COVID-19 in the U.S. Many healthcare workers, like Amy Arland, continue to be overloaded by caring for COVID-19 patients. Globally, COVID-19 has presented unique challenges, leading to increased mental health issues among healthcare workers.
There were many nights that I didn't think I could go back and do it again. You know, you only are responsible for 2 patients as an ICU nurse, and when you lose them both in one night after you've given everything you've got and you really start to feel like what you do is pointless, there were many times that I almost called it quits. I didn't think that I could do this anymore. I could be a nurse anymore. I reached a really low point where I started to resent everybody. I hated my patients. I hated the people I worked with. You know, it was a pretty miserable few months when we hit our third surge. And I said, if I survive this surge, that's it, I'm done.
Deja Maynard is a licensed clinical social worker based in North Carolina. She offers perspective on the realities of trauma and grief.
It is pretty much inconceivable, right, to imagine that she, you know, in particular, and all of the other, you know, healthcare frontline workers who decided to, you know, push through, you know, who are still pushing through, it would be inconceivable for them to develop any kind of resiliency to sort of all of the things that make such a situation like this distressing, to continue their work. And I think in this particular, with this particular situation, you know, PTSD is about, you know, it's a trauma response, in that the brain cannot be certain that any situation that is like that sort of initial trauma, that original sort of entry point of that trauma, isn't, you know, is actually different. So your brain and your body is responding as if the trauma is still ongoing. And in this particular instance, right, the length of the pandemic is kind of like this subsequent re-traumatization, right? Like, this person is constantly in the same situation that, you know, caused sort of those initial trauma wounds. And so I think that trying to do our best as those outside of it, you know, this is kind of, we're sort of splitting the difference here because I am a therapist, but doing our best to try to understand, you know, sort of the depth and breadth of that, is kind of where that empathy and that support, you know, that genuine empathy and support, I think, can come from, you know, where we can really sort of make it okay for people to talk about their grief, right? The grief is immense. We understand grief absolutely when people pass away, but I mean, I often talk with my clients about needing to grieve expectations too. The loss of a safety net, you know, recognizing that before they could save most people, to realizing that most people, you know, they're not going to be able to save, that is in its own, necessitates its own grief process.
I was staying with some friends that, you know, rented a room out to me and my family, and we stayed there for a while. But once things started shutting down due to COVID, they were getting scared themselves. So they basically gave us a month to move out.
That's Derek, a pseudonym. He, his wife, and child found themselves homeless at the start of the pandemic.
I couldn't find a place within the city, the area, or even the state that that I could literally move to. So I had to literally move out of state. And because I had to move out of state, I had to quit my job. I couldn't continue to drive back and forth, you know, from another state 8 hours away just to get to work. I mean, even though there were a few places that were hiring, for almost every job I applied to, I got denied work. So it just made a bad situation worse.
Before experiencing homelessness, Derek worked at Amazon in California. Then COVID hit, and the little bit of security he had was stripped away. In an attempt to locate affordable housing and greater job opportunities, he moved his family to Nevada, where the cost of living was cheaper.
My first big concern was trying to find housing. That's where I ended up where I'm at now, which is the budget suites. It's like a hotel, but they rent either weekly or monthly. This particular place do bi-weekly or monthly. And I like this campus better than where I was staying at before. But now it's like trying to find work, which was difficult during the pandemic because there were quite literally no place hiring. And casinos were shut down. So a lot more people were going on unemployment. I mean, it did literally, at one point, the unemployment rate in the state reached 30%. Very recently, over the last month, you know, it has dropped back down to below 10%. So I'm still trying to be hopeful.
Since relocating to Nevada, Derek has had some successes. He found housing and was able to get some temporary assistance, but he has run into other challenges trying to navigate complex social service systems.
I feel grateful for being able to get what we've been able to get. And it's funny, after talking to lots of people in and out of the government assistance sector and so forth, a lot of times they have said, you know, it's very easy for a woman and a child to be able to get assistance, but to include a man, it's not quite so easy, because lots of times they think or consider that the man should be able to go out and get a job, which for me, that really put a lot more pressure upon me to have to be the person to find work and have to be able to provide for the family. And hearing that my daughter and wife would be better off without me felt, it has a particular type of sting as far as how men are being supported. It's like, I know for a while, you know, there's women's rights and women's empowerment, things are quite unfair for women, but just doesn't mean you gotta make things unfair to men to help support women. I mean, I'm a man, I'm trying to support women, you know, I have a daughter, I have a wife, I'm trying to do the best that I can to be able to support them, but you know, I am limited with what I'm able to do at this moment, and I need assistance. And assisting me is assisting these women as well.
In this situation with, you know, losing his job during this period of devastation for many people, depending on what the logistics of their home was, but this could be many of us, you know, in these types of situations.
Kerry Mackey Sr. is a psychiatry specialist. He offers perspective on feelings of hopelessness and vulnerability.
This is common, you know, and I think what we need to understand, not only as people of color and men, but, you know, as a people in general that people go through stuff and that it is okay not to be okay at times. I think we have this built up foundational structure around us of resiliency and feeling like, you know, we can't have any weakness. We can't have any moments of fragility, but that's not the case for many people. You know, we have to allow ourselves to be vulnerable, to kind of make those efforts to reach out and try to seek assistance. And I think, you know, what was so demeaning in all of this was the fact that, you know, he put his pride to the side, you know, as a man that was a provider for his family and reached out for help. And then as a family, they were told that, oh, it would be better off if you weren't married, essentially, because more would be afforded to your wife and your child. Essentially, they said that we could take care of your family better than you could take care of your family. And that would in itself is demeaning. That would in itself is the probably one of the most and one of the easiest things that could make a man that is primarily the provider in his household to feel hopeless.
I keep trying to keep my head up because I'm afraid of having doubts. At times I feel like whenever I do have a doubt, something bad happens. I feel like it comes in the form of, you know, if you start thinking it, it happens. So I want to feel optimistic, like, you know, the best is going to come and the best is just right there on the edge. And I know it's not that far, but it becomes difficult in seeing it being there. But I have faith that it's there. And it's just a struggle in trying not to be so negative-minded and putting myself back in a sad position and feeling sadness and being sad and being doubtful. I mean, it's a struggle.
For most parents, balancing children and a career can be stressful. For some, simple everyday issues can become magnified and seemingly insurmountable. For parents like Shanette Jackson, anxieties were heightened while balancing both work and parenthood during the pandemic.
I was taking my Zoom call from my phone for this particular meeting because I had to pick up books from my children's school. And so I'm on my call with executive staff and some other members of my team, and I'm thinking that I'm muted. I muted myself, and I was telling my children to put their shoes on because we had to run out and go pick up their books. And so my son kept asking me, why? Where are we going? Why do I have to go? I'm like, just put on your shoes. And I'm just like trying to whisper to him, just put on your shoes so we can go. And he kept repeating while I'm in this meeting. And at some point during this call, as I was moving around, I unmuted myself and I did not know. And so he asked me one more time and I said, can you please go put on your blankety shoes? Thank you. And my boss says, Shanette, you know the mute button works, right? And I was like, oh, God, Lord have mercy. I would say that was the height of my anxiety right there, that moment. I was thrown into an instant like, oh, Lord have mercy. My whole team just heard me blankety blank at my kids. And that was really embarrassing. And so the funny thing about it, though, so I was really embarrassed. I was completely stressed out and thoroughly embarrassed by it. I got several text messages and emails that were like, that was like the best thing ever. People were like so like really happy to hear me be a human being, like to be normal. Someone emailed me, was like, that was like the realest thing that I've heard all week. It was like the best thing that I've heard, because a lot of us were dealing with the same thing, but I just happened to be the one that got caught like really kind of barking and like snapping. It it helped people go, yes, I'm not the only one. But two, it actually helped me realize, like, you're going to have to exercise more patience with these children, because if you said anything to them that you didn't want your team to hear, then you shouldn't say it to them at all. You know what I'm saying? So it actually kind of put me in a place to where I was going to have to be a lot more understanding towards them, because we were in this together, and I didn't want it to be a negative experience of just like our anxieties bouncing off of each other the whole time we were at home. That would be disastrous for the children. It would be disastrous for me as a mother. It would be an epic fail. So I think at that was the point and the height of my anxiety where I realized that I had to change the paradigm. I had to really rethink how I was going to proceed with homeschooling and balancing out my work and my children's lives to be a more balanced, emotionally balanced mother for them, to not turn this into like the worst year of their life.
For a lot of industries, for a lot of professionals, this pandemic has really, like, the kind of ethos is that people are to become superhuman.
Licensed clinical social worker Deja Maynor offers insight about Shanette's situation and the all too familiar challenge of juggling kids and work during the pandemic.
You know, if you're working from home, and that's also where you're parenting and all these other things, your humanness showing up, you know, should almost be expected. And instead, it's kind of like, oh my gosh, people are in a position to be embarrassed by that. And so I feel like that's sort of where my mind initially came up, that there's just this weird juxtaposition about how human the pandemic has kind of made us realize that we are, or it's kind of forced us to be, so to speak, juxtaposition to this, like, you know, you gotta do more, you should be available, you should, you know, like all of these kind of like internal narratives about what we should be doing, how we should be handling it. And that ultimately turning into, you know, some pretty unrealistic expectations for people. So that's kind of the first piece. The second piece, though, like specific to that profound insight that you know, this person had, like, you know, sort of her encouraging herself to do a little bit more probing, like probing deeper, like, well, what is it about this that made me embarrassed? And realizing that it's literally about, I wouldn't want anyone to know that I talk to my kid like that. It seems like it really set up the circumstances for her to consider how her child is there impacted and encourage her to make a change. And I think that that is phenomenal. I'd be like, if she was sort of my client, I'd be praising her not only for the grace that she's extending, but also for her willingness to sort of like take ownership of what's happening.
For many parents, the struggle to incorporate their new normal and meet realistic parenting expectations was a challenge. Therapist Deja Maynor.
I think a lot of people might had already kind of had some ideas about how they could improve maybe their work-life balance, or, you know, their boundaries around work as to how it's impacting their family. I mean, I think the pandemic, or at least it's been in my experience, the pandemic really exploded people's concerns around that, because there wasn't any more like strict demarcation between like when you're at home and when you're at work, in the ways that, you know, you had previously been able to encourage people to use that as that kind of like signaling, right? Like when you hit the door from coming home from your office, you're in mommy mode and it's okay to leave everything behind. But really, you know, if the kitchen table became your office too, as well as where your kids, you know, where you have dinner with your kids or wherever, those strategies no longer worked. And so I would say people really kind of struggled with sort of feeling like they just were not doing a good job because they did not know how. And I would just encourage people, like, you would not know how. So we could work together to create some realistic expectations.
Over the course of the pandemic, many people were trying to figure out their new normal. For many, the unknowns were humbling and caused people like Derek to reflect on what's most precious in life.
I want to be a man that stands up and works and help provide and be there for his family. I want to be in my daughter's life, not just a man that says I want to be in the daughter's life and have to fight for visiting and so forth and have custody and blah, blah, blah. I'm not trying to separate from my wife neither.
Derek has worked the majority of his adult life. When married in 2017, he was the sole provider for his family. However, the past couple of years have been rocky, with unstable employment and a range of health problems. And to complicate the situation further, Derek has sickle cell anemia. And due to a torn meniscus, his wife now depends on a walker to get around. Together, they are trying to earn a living, care for each other and their child, but it hasn't been easy.
I'm trying to be a man that stands there and holds the hand of his wife and child and being their life and work to continue to be able to try to put food on the table. And at the moment, I'm unable to. So, yes, I am also relying upon the government to help assist me with that as well. I just pray for us to be able to survive. I prayed on everything, just praying and praying and praying, and which, you know, hoping that something would come around. Because it just really happened tough.
It's rough, man. I might need a therapist, man. I can't front.
Asantewa Boykin is a registered ER nurse in Sacramento, California.
I don't think that I have, as someone who's been on the front line, has been intentional about unpacking the trauma of last year. I would encourage that anyone would go about doing that, but there are moments where I'm just like, I lived. Two, oh my God, nobody close to me died from this. Like, it's a waver between feeling grateful and guilty. And feeling like I, you know, thrown away, and also praised at the same time, like, oh my God, you're a hero. Like, but why wouldn't you wear masks though? So people didn't get sick, right? So yeah, no, I might have to go see a therapist for myself specifically, but not today.
Asantewa's expressed emotions of survivor's remorse aren't uncommon. Clinical therapist Deja Maynard.
People are often conditioned to consider how much worse someone else has it. And while I think that there are some admirable kind of like motivations behind that, you know, you're hoping to teach people to become more empathetic, you know, become less self-centered. What ultimately is happening, or at least what I often find to be happening, is people are invalidating their own emotional experiences as a result of thinking about how much worse someone else has it. And so as such, I'm like, yes, it might be different for someone else, but that does not mean that you're not feeling any less of what you're feeling.
The pandemic has forced us to face harsh realities, and no one has been closer to the heartbreak and pain caused by COVID than our frontline workers, like Amy Arland, the RN from Fresno we heard from earlier.
The breakthrough moment for me was one of my therapists, I swear I'll be with him forever, is just teaching me, I don't even know, I think the biggest part of it was learning how to get past the fear. You know, fear is the mind killer. It's the one thing that really holds so many people back from doing the things that they need to do in their lives. And I lived in so much fear all of the time that it was what he called radical acceptance. I had to learn to get past the fear and find my courage to keep going.
For Making Contact, I'm Anita Johnson, reporting from Berkeley, California. Thanks to all the participants and experts who contributed to this week's episode. If you suspect that you or someone you know may be struggling with anxiety or depression, contact the National Helpline at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-HELP. Thanks for listening. And again, you're tuned to Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. Again, we want to thank Making Contact for allowing us to present Life During COVID. For further information, you can always log on to radioproject.org. And up next, we have more Hard Knock Radio with Poor News Network. Stay tuned.
Maya,
who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
It's funny how money changes situation. Miscommunication leads to complication.
Bienvenidos a Radio Prensa Pobre. Welcome to Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. From the streets to the bus shelters. This is your co-host Muteado Silencio, con voces de migrantes en resistencia, in studio today with Poverty Scala, Popoid, co-host mi carnala Tiny.
Yeah, that's PNN, not CNN, people. Anthropology, ethnography, psychology. The study about us, without us. Our spirits, our cultures, our traditions, through your lens, deconstructing our struggles while our communities are dismantled and left in rubble.
AKKdemia and Away Nation, from UC Berkeley to the Temple University, on today's broadcast of Poor People's Radio, we speak with Darvin L. Baldwin, author of the new book In the Shadows of the Ivory Tower, about the extractive industry of academia. And then on to Black Indigenous warrior, sister fighting the sweeps of houseless relatives on stolen indigenous Anishinaabe land.
I went to school with some redneck crackers. Right around the time Third Base dropped the Cactus album, but I was reading Malcolm. I changed my name in 89, cleaning parts of my brain like a baby nine. I took a history class serious.
Up next, we will speak with Tiberian L. Baldwin, author of the new book In the Shadow of Ivory Tower, How Universities Are Plundering Cities.
It was a powerful experience for me to learn about a recent book that just came out called In the Shadow of the Ivory Tower, How Universities Are Plundering Our Cities, written by a powerful warrior of truth, Devarian L. Baldwin. And we are blessed to have this warrior right on Poor People's Radio. Welcome, Devarian, to Poor People's Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So maybe you could start by just telling listeners how you came to this, as someone I think who also works in that institution.
Yeah, I am a university professor, so there's no question about that. Well compensated and taken care of, and I was actually doing more historical archival work in the city of Chicago, Southside, and at the University of Chicago, and I came out of the building, and there was history hitting me in the face. There were chants and protest, and I followed the sound to the administration building and saw these placards and signs and individuals that didn't look like the normal students on campus, Black, brown, and older, chanting, "U of C, look at your history," with charges of cultural theft. And as a scholar, I did the investigation and found out that the University of Chicago had not only supported the historic Checkerboard Lounge Jazz and Blues Club on the near south side, near the campus, not far from the campus, to the north of the campus. But they had started the process of purchasing it and moving it into the Harper Court retail district of the university neighborhood. So they're taking the historic Black Jazz and Blues Club and relocating it to serve their entertainment interests and needs in the campus community. And as I delve deeper into this, I realized this is just the tip of the iceberg, that this one purchase represented a larger story about how this one university had controlled the South Side or parts of the South Side since its founding in the 1890s in terms of housing and labor and policing. And as I began to share the story, people, especially in academia, like, well, yeah, well, what about USC in South Central? Right. What about NYU in Columbia and Greenwich Village in Harlem? And the story just went on. What about Yale and New Haven, UPenn in West Philadelphia? The story went on and on and on. There was a story here. It was bigger than an anecdote. It was systemic. It was powerful. And most of these urban universities, but also some college towns, not by accident, sit in historically or predominantly Black and brown working class neighborhoods. And there's a story to that. And I wanted to investigate and uncover that. And I wanted to bring it up to the present and explore, how do we get to the point where we're living in what I call these universe cities, these neighborhoods, these entire urban environments where higher education has a growing control over the economic development and also the political governance of our cities? And what are the consequences for people striving, surviving, struggling in the shadows of these ivory towers? And that's a story that I wanted to tell. And some people have begun to investigate this story, this relationship between higher education and their host cities or towns. But it's mostly very academic, policy-oriented, maps, etc. And I began to realize, as I started talking to people, that the clearest indicator of the true health and well-being, and the good or the bad or the ugly of these institutions, can only be reflected in the people who live and work in their shadows. And so this book is driven by over 100 interviews of everyday folk, largely Black and brown or white working class, who clean the floors, wash the windows, who are profiled by the campus police, who fight to get adequate health care from the university hospitals, who struggle to maintain affordable housing as campuses expand to their neighborhoods. It's their stories that amplify and drive this larger epic transformation.
We say we're not trying to smash the academy, or as I call it, academia, right? We're trying to make space on the bench. Because we know, as you beautifully articulated, that it's a struggle to stay alive in many of these places where I like to think it's the example of the colonial project, these institutions. You probably know about Temple University and the way that it's destroyed and stolen block after block of poor people color neighborhoods. My mama used to live there, and I had the terrifying experience of going back and seeing what I call the dorm industrial complex.
Actually, in the history of higher education, we use the phrase military industrial complex, but historically, we don't know that originally that term included another word. The original term was the military industrial academic complex. It's actually embedded in the history, the actual history of how these institutions work. There was a senator actually in California who was at Stanford criticizing the collusion between the federal government, military industrial spending, the university research and development, and its expansion into neighborhoods, and explaining it and describing it as the military-industrial academic complex. So this is real. And you mentioned the story of the bones at UC Berkeley. There's an East Coast parallel story. If you know anything about the move, Tree and Delisha Africa, the children that were killed in the move bombing, their bones were taken and studied by the University of Pennsylvania's museum and kept, you know, as a curio, never returned to their families until just this past year after a massive protest and outrage. So these institutions, they pull from the same handbook. And you mentioned, you know, the Bay Area. I've been speaking with brothers and sisters out there, you know, that have read some of my work, and they amplify the story of 1921 Walnut Street, an affordable housing complex. Yeah. And they put me up on game about the fact that what happens when a university becomes a developer, because there is a clause in the California state constitution that allows, if a building is purchased by a California state university, even if that building is protected by local affordable housing or rent control policy. The authority of that state university usurps any local governance and protections in those buildings. And so that's what happened with 1921 Waldo Street. When the university bought it, it went from being an affordable building with rent control for residents to now being turned into a high-end luxury student housing for international students who are full payers. So these institutions, they create these independent republics of self-governance and autonomy and control in the middle of existing communities and cities. And we need to understand this. Their power is that, unlike Amazon or Halliburton or other private industries, these corporations, and that's what they are, these corporations, they hide behind the idea of higher education being a public good. That just simply by being an institution of higher education, everything they do is for the good of the public. But it's precisely that status of being a public good institution that gives their property holdings tax-exempt status. And so because of that, all these for-profit activities take place on campus buildings: research and development for science, pharmaceuticals, military industrial weaponry, software industries. All this research and development takes shape on these campus buildings, and it's all covered under a tax shelter. Now, of course, where would those taxes normally go as these campuses expand into our neighborhoods with this for-profit work? Those taxes would go to things like public schools, trash removal, bridge and road maintenance. So there's a direct correlation between the prosperity of these campuses and their buildings of glass and steel and all of this wonderful luxury that we're seeing and that we celebrate in terms of innovation. That innovation is underwritten by the taxes they don't pay that would go to working families and neighborhoods that surround these campuses. And it's important for your listeners to understand that.
Yes, and I'm so glad you brought up 1921 Walnut. And on our Stolen Land Tour, we actually included 1921 Walnut. We also, let's shout out to People's Park, okay? And the,
that's right.
Right? And the absolute desecration. And our ultimately, people died trying to save mm-hmm. People's Park. Mm-hmm. But the war machine, excuse me, university, that is UC Berkeley, came mm-hmm. down with the pigs, and that was it. And I want to bring up, though, as you bring this up, because in this conversation, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about UC San Francisco that currently got in bed with the mayor over there and struck a deal to basically hire private police to lead 24-hour sweeps. And, you know, I critique that, sweeping us humans like we're trash. Of mm-hmm. poor and houseless people out of a hood, because again, they were building a luxury residence for their high-end
right.
students. I just wanted to give listeners some information on how they can get this badass book. Could you let people
okay,
know?
Yeah. Go to bookshop or your local bookstore, not Amazon, and get it. It's In the Shadow of the Ivy Tower, How Universes Are Plundering Our Cities, with an activist press, Bold Type Books, formerly Nation Books for the Nation magazine. Happy to be affiliated with them. I appreciate any support, but if you can't get the book, get it from the library, read it, let's talk. I'm available for conversation on Twitter, at DeVarian Baldwin. And just to be clear, this book is written in the tradition of different forms of knowledge production. This is written in the tradition of the Black Studies movements at San Francisco State and the Black Panther Party at Merritt College. And the fact that even in the history of higher education, there were examples that were driven by Black studies when it wasn't just about curriculum, but from the very beginning, they understood that it had to be public-facing and community-serving.
Thank you so much, Darvin. Talk to you soon.
You are listening to PNN Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. After this short music break, we will hear Monica Washington Padula, a Black indigenous sister warrior against police sweeps of houseless people and stolen land.
It was a place I used to call home. I tried to chase the energy, but now it's all gone. And only memories remain. I try to feel the feeling, but the city ain't the same. They say it's all to improve, but tell me where communities are supposed to move when they've been living in a trap, and those who make it out are hardly ever giving back.
So we back with Poor People's Radio, as we heard about the extractive industry called AKKdemia. we know that these institutions and these corporations and all the tricksters and basically all the haters that follow continue to sweep all of our houseless bodies like we're trash. We also know that we're on stolen land all across occupied Turtle Island. We're blessed at Poor People's Radio to bring on a sister warrior who is actually speaking up on these things and activating liberation from a whole other perspective in line with how we roll out here. Monica Washington Padula, welcome to Poor People's Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'm speaking to you from Kalamazoo, Michigan, or Kikinamazo, Gazigmaze, Michigamma. Out here is a lot of Anishinaabeg people, Three Fires people. That means the Ojibwe, the Odawa, and the Potawatomi. I have Ojibwe ancestry. I'm Black. I have some European ancestry, but I definitely root in my Black culture and then also I'm reclaiming Anishinaabeg culture. So I appreciate you giving me some time and some space and highlighting this because we need the attention, we need the support, and we need the eyes on what's going on here.
Tell us what's going on in your territory.
Over here in Kalamazoo, I say this because once you get to know who you are, you learn more about your histories. And for me, it's about interconnecting. What is the interconnected space that Black folks who are also displaced Indigenous people and Anishinaabe and other Turtle Island folks, like we live in a multi-nation piece of land here. At first, I didn't make the connection with the sweeps. The reason I finally made the connection was because I realized that the things that were happening by seeing some video footage of how the police were behaving. They were destroying property, hearing they're waking people up at the crack of dawn. They have 5 minutes to get up, 5 minutes, and then you got to go. And they've got the tractor there ready to load all their stuff up and throw it in the trash. And they got to find somewhere to go quick. I said, that's not right. And so I started trying to pull together, you know, like what was happening. And I said to myself, you know, it's really something that we were on unceded land after they pushed all the Native people out in Kalamazoo. Some of the richest families here were part and parcel to the displacement and massacre of the Indigenous people here that were forcibly removed. And they started by burning the homes down. And then on top of that, you know, as Black people were migrating north and finding places to live that were safer, the settlers came and they began redlining the areas. And so the north side of Kalamazoo is a historically redlined area. There is a red brick part of the street that separates downtown from the north side. And the story I was told is that that red brick by the train tracks, that was where Black people were not supposed to cross. They weren't supposed to cross that line, literal red line, that they weren't supposed to cross or they could be lynched. Native people were allowed to come across the line to trade. But once they wanted the Native people removed, they didn't want any Native people here at all. And so they removed them violently by tricking them into thinking they were giving them food commodities. And anybody that wouldn't get on the train and get out, they massacred. We need community on the ground. We need activists on the ground really pulling together and fighting back on these systems. And so that day that I went out, there were other activists there from other groups like Food Not Bombs and such. It was really a mixed group, literally. When the police came, it's swarms of police, right? And you got houseless people. You're on the red line side of town, the east side, which is another red line area of town. It's poor folks over there, Black folks over there. They started arresting demonstrators. And some of the demonstrators were houseless people, but they were houseless people who are resisting the brutality. They arrested six other people with me that they charged with felonies. So I'm facing four felony charges, two accounts of resisting and obstructing, two accounts of felony assault on an officer with a dangerous weapon, and that was my mace, my self-defense spray, and a flagpole that they claim I hit somebody with. The two things that really stood out to me from that was I was criminalized for refusing to stand down from someone that was not being given adequate medical attention. I was targeted for recording that and for advocating for that person. They put me in jail. They set my bail at $10,000. I went 20 hours with no medical care because they denied me medical care. I went 20 hours with no phone call to be able to let people know what was going on. And the things that I heard and saw in the jail were equally disturbing, if not more so, because once you're out of the public eye, nobody can really give an account of what they're doing to you. So one thing we're doing in Kalamazoo is as soon as we know that somebody went in and as soon as we know that they're trying to file excessive charges or bogus charges against us, we're speaking out. And we are trying our best to make sure the public knows about this person, who they are, get their bail raised if that's what we can do, show up at their court date, because they're running wild out here. And there really is a war against BIPOC people and vulnerable people, which includes the houseless folks. And best believe that if a black or brown person is houseless, they're going to get everything black or brown means while also not having a place to stay. We're still trying to figure out how to keep people from being displaced and illegally evicted. Landlords, someone missed a payment, whether they have COVID or not, no matter what happens, people are just evicting people and doing them dirty. We don't have no place for people to go. 90% of any available units are filled. The Gospel Mission has been reported as an unsafe place for people to go. We don't have churches opening up their buildings. You know, I keep saying, people who are housed and people who have any advantage, if you have income coming in, if your job is pretty reliable and steady, if you have an advantage, especially if you have a leverage, pull, or power with anybody in the city, you should be out there or advocating. Because what's happening is not right, and it's going to hurt, if not kill, individuals, and that blood is going to be on the city.
Can you tell listeners real quick how they can sign that petition and make sure that all those charges get dropped?
My Instagram is at Moni Says, M-O-N-I-S-A-Y-Z. Same on my Twitter. I have the link in my Instagram bio, and there's videos. You can also go to BLM KZOO BC, K-Z-O-O-B-C, and you can see what's being lifted up there as well. You know, Kalamazoo presents as a small city, but it's got big, deep, corrupt problems, and it needs to be exposed.
We will talk soon, fam.
It's funny how money changes situations. Miscommunication leads to complications.
So that's all for this segment of Poor News Network. If you want to hear any of our Poor People's Revolutionary Radio, you can subscribe to Poor Magazine SoundCloud channel or find and subscribe to Poor News Network on YouTube. Thanks to Anita Johnson, David D, and Anthony Fest for the media access, and all of you for listening. All power to the people.
Hard knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop, EMN, at it again. Sandman, daddy man, Chris Juwan Kim. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone, hard knock. Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Anita and Davey D.
Yeah, right, feel me, yeah.
On and down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Woo.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they're ready from the steel gray beats. Say please, maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to the lovers I need with a please. Hey, some shade on your name in the street. You go.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coach. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
Let's go.
Look what you've done.
No, 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 no,
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand.